Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Musician's Mentor Podcast. As usual, I'm your host, Travis Mark, and I'm extremely excited to say that my guest today is LA-based session guitarist, Adam Zimmern. Adam currently plays with Ziggy Marley, but has a host of credits to his name, including Chris Brown, Vida Blue, Iggy Pop, Dido, Shakira, Lizzy, you name it, he's probably done it. And we're going to talk about that and so much more in today's episode. As usual, let me please remind you that if you're enjoying these episodes, to please leave us a rating or review, as it really helps us. Away from that, check out the links in the show notes for Adam's information. And don't forget that we're trying to do the whole TikTok thing now, so you can follow us there at Musician's Mentor. Let's jump straight into it. Ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Adam Zimmern. Adam Zimmern, thank you so much for joining me on the Musician's Mentor Podcast. I know it's super weird, and it's something I'm trying to potentially get out of as these episodes progress, but usually what I do is I ask my guests to do a brief introduction as to who they are. I don't need like the full history. I just like to give my listeners a little bit of a bullet point type idea so that they have an idea on a few things that you've done, even though I'll record an intro and post, but more so that they get an idea of where you're coming from. So if you'd be kind enough, please tell us who Adam Zimmern is.
Okay, well, to try and keep it brief, that's a challenge, I guess. I grew up in Long Island, New York, and it might be worth noting I didn't even know I was going to be. I'm a guitar player, and I didn't have plans to play guitar as a career, probably until, you know, maybe my second or third year of college. And I didn't even go to college, even though I went to a great music school, for music originally. So that, you know, we can get into that. But so I went from New York to Miami and ended up in Miami, ended up staying there, and ended up being involved in, stayed in Miami so that I could get better, because I didn't feel like I could qualify in New York, and but end up getting immersed in all that world of music down there, and just trying to work. And so that was a whole trip. So I played a lot of Latin music, I played with Cuban musicians, I played with in a Spanish language rock band, and that led me to doing pop music and playing with Shakira, which was probably my first big, like, sort of legit touring and recording jobs. But at the same time, I always had a band down there that was sort of where I was able to let my sort of freak flag fly, and spent, I think, 15 years post-college down there. And it opened a ton of doors for me, as much as, and it's how I got involved in sort of the jam band scene. And eventually, after just sort of feeling a little too comfortable and a little, not dead-ended, but just too comfortable is maybe the one way of describing it, I moved to LA in a weird way to sort of reconnect with, like, my you know, sort of more Anglo-New Yorker roots, and play some more like rock music and songwriter stuff. And along the way, just hustled a ton of different gigs. I don't know if you really want to go through like the resume stuff.
You know, we don't need to do that, but I do love the hustle stuff, you know, and we'll get into some of that, I'm sure, because, you know, as I briefly touched upon when we started, the whole point of this podcast is to talk more about, you know, yeah, being a musician's cool, and everybody who loves music loves to hear musicians talk about music, and you know, depending on who you're talking to about music, there's all these different layers that you can get into. But I find that while it's easy to find a teacher per se. Like if you want to say learn guitar, we're living in this beautiful time where you can push a button and you've found a guitar teacher or a video, and you, if you're diligent enough, you can learn guitar. But I love hearing the things that make musicians tick. You know, I love listening to stories about, well, like, dude, how did you figure out that you could get that gig? Or you know, versus like, hey, all my friends were using Tube Screamer pedals, so I bought a Tube Screamer pedal, you know? So we're definitely going to get into the hustle thing. And I've got a list of your credits here, which I can't even mention every single one because we don't have the time, but I will mention all your credits in the introduction that I'm going to do.
It's okay. but I was going to just try and wrap it up was what I moved to LA, and then, you know, as circumstance would have it, I ended up sort of my current gig, which is playing reggae.
Amazing.
which living in Miami or being Caribbean adjacent and playing some reggae in Miami did help. And, you know, so there's a little bit of a full circle thing there. But anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, Ziggy, we're going to get to him as well. So I want to just back up a little bit here. I know you said you didn't have the intention of like even doing the music thing at the start until like your third year. You grew up in New York. You mentioned that you studied in Miami, lived there for a while, and then relocated to LA. So we've covered all of that very briefly. I want to, if you wouldn't mind, I want to delve in a little bit about location. How important do you think it is for musicians to be in the right location, inverted commas? And tell me why, when you decided to study, what made you choose Miami?
So I do think location is important. But maybe not for the most obvious reasons for me. The location was important for me in that, so I'll go back to the end of the question first, about why I went to Miami. But the thing about, for me, location was staying where I was in at the time, where I knew I could get work. And it wasn't that I was getting great work or I was some sort of, you know, big figure on the scene. My feeling was that when I got into the Miami Music School, but I was not a performance major. I had a principal instrument as jazz guitar. So I was a little bit fringy, and I felt like I needed to get good. One of the things that, at least music school in Miami, one of the things that's good, it's a plus and a minus, is it's a little bit isolated, and there isn't a lot of curriculum, and it makes sense too. There's no way that you can put that into a curriculum that gets funded that says like, go out in the city and gig, right? There's no like street smarts part of studying at music school.
Yeah.
That's involved. That's your peers and all that stuff. And so the feeling I had was that if I went back to New York, I'd have to land back with my parents who lived about 20 miles from New York City. And I really just felt like I didn't feel like I had the tools to survive in New York City. And I felt like if I stayed in Miami, I could share a house and live real cheap. And I could hustle to keep the lights on there and get good on stage and say yes to everything. Right. So, which I'm sure you've heard a lot on the music industry. So in Miami, I knew enough people, and basically I wasn't even sure of it as a career until I started playing in bands with people in college. And some of the people I was playing in bands with were sort of these performance majors who that's what they were doing. So I thought, well, I guess I can give this a shot too, since we're playing together and I seem to be holding on. So, and the peer group that I had seemed to, you know, made me feel like I was starting to be qualified. But at the same time, I wasn't a guy that could really do club dates or like had the jazz repertoire or skills or the language really down. I was working on it, but it to get better at my instrument, and I loved it, but you know, I kind of knew. So the feeling of staying there was a little bit that I could like, I could play wedding gigs and I could do like, I had play in bands and just try and like get experience there. And so, where in New York, like life is kind of a lot harder, you know, it's almost monastic. And to, even if you have to live in Manhattan, you'd have to like, you know, in Miami, it's like I shared a house with somebody. I had a car. We drove around. You know what I mean? So maybe I was taking the easy way a little bit in that sense. But that location let me sort of just go out and be in the music scene and play with people and do weird, crazy gigs and be kind of immerse myself in that world that I was already starting to get involved in, and just like it was quicker and more immediate, and also I felt like was open to where I could get better on stage.
Yeah,
you know. So yeah, and then that led me into all these different sort of things that were really like way different from anything that I knew growing up, but I was just like saying yes and around all these people. And in school too, I was around, you know, one of my closest friends was Brazilian, and so Brazilian music and Cubans everywhere and all that stuff, you know. So being down there really was kind of the way I saw it, the only way for me to sort of get good enough to survive. That's, you know, subjective, obviously. And that feeling of being good enough to survive never goes away. It's still there when I wake up every morning. You know what I mean?
I know it well.
And it's still in doubt. You know what I mean? It's still like, you never know. So, but that was just, when you're younger, you know, you're even a little more empowered by what you don't know.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, it helped, I think, staying there.
What were you doing to start getting the gigs? Like, so you were saying yes to the gigs. Were your peer group getting gigs and offering you gigs, or were you going out to try and get gigs? Did you answer like Craigslist's ads or things like that?
I think music school and the community of players and people, when I was in school, I started to go to like blues jams and things like that. I couldn't go to jazz jams. That was not my thing. Or I didn't feel comfortable doing that. But I started to like, and Miami in a way was kind of small, so you started to go and play. And so it was still, yeah, the community at school there. And so there'd be somebody who'd be like, I have this wedding band gig or top 40 gig. And then at the same time, you're like getting into, you're playing in bands too. Yeah. And then they're picking up things along the way. And ideally you're trying to make recordings too, or get your foot into that, which is, you know, it really important that you don't know what you don't know, because that whole world, like the first time I was in a studio with somebody that was like an experienced studio, it was just incredible how far off I was. It was sort of like, you know, yeah, we're going to have to rent all the gear and, you know, like keep trying, you know what I mean? So it was that you just sort of like, you keep kind of getting involved in community and then going out and meeting new people. And every time you see a band that you think is cool, you're meeting them, and you're just, you know, it's weird in a sense. In hindsight, it didn't really feel like you're really trying to meet people that hard. It just felt like everyone's sort of in this stew doing the same thing.
Yeah, that's cool.
So the like-minded people sort of attach, and you know, in hindsight, what you want to be a part of is kind of an art scene. You know, like I'd rather, maybe it's a little aspirational, but all the great, even looking at like music that you admire, jazz or right, like in a lot of ways, people don't realize they come out of art scenes. So you want to have like a bunch of people that are just like trying to make stuff and be around people that are involved in making things. And that's art as like the verb, you know, you're doing something. And so, and my roommate who you've interviewed, Brendan,
yeah.
We were living together. I didn't start with him, but it was all like, there were these houses that musicians lived in. And so I moved into one of those houses and shared a room with other musicians. And then that had turnover to new musicians. And so that's sort of what's happening. You're just in the middle of this scene. And I think that's the best thing that comes out of being at music school, even though, you know, even if Miami is like a really small one compared to someplace like Berkeley is, as I understand it. But, So, that's the main thing, you know, in a way. And I just saw like even just the logistics of doing that in New York as being sort of too much, like setting me back too far and not being able to like, I just wanted to be on stage, getting good on stage, because I learned real quickly that the skills that I was getting in school were technically really important and really valuable, but communicating on stage and getting good on stage is a completely different thing. And I hadn't really done that.
Yeah, completely. What initially about the music bit you? What about the music bug bit you, if you want to phrase it like that? Like you said at the top of the interview that you weren't sure that you were even going to go in the music direction. So, you know, I'm sorry if it's ignorant, but just tell me a little bit about the background. Like, how old were you when you started playing, and what was it during your kind of college years that made you think, you know what, actually, I think I totally want to do this, you know?
Yeah, well, I owe my parents a lot of credit in that, you know, my dad was like probably like a lot of musicians you interview now, this my generation of he was a physician, he was a doctor, and not like doctor, but we're all like kind of have to have some sort of middle class or you know thing to sort of get involved, yeah, to have the privilege to get involved, which I learned after I played with Cuban musicians and reggae musicians that they didn't have that privilege. And I learned I wanted to sound like that. Anyway, that's another story. But my dad was, he really loved what he did, right? He was really interested in what he did for a living. He really cared about it. And it was a thing that, like, he was kind of obsessed with. And so that was something that was always a little bit imparted to me. And I was fortunate in that even in high school and middle school, my parents didn't look at – I was not a great student. I was, like, you know, B student.
That's still pretty good.
Which it's pretty good by D, you know, low B, but by today's metrics, you know, it's like but they thought I was doing pretty good because I was, yeah, I still, sorry to be rambling.
Not at all.
They were okay with it because I was into a bunch of other, I was into stuff. I had interests, mm-hmm, and he was understood, like I'd get in trouble for doing poorly in school, but like I was into music, I was into, so one of the other thing I was into was, speaking of privilege, was playing golf, and I got pretty good at that, and So I was just sort of, I had like school, but I had, and probably around fifth or sixth grade, I started playing guitar. But early on, my parents made me play, I took violin lessons as a really young child, like the, you know, first grade or something. And then I didn't like that. And then I took my brother, I had older brothers and sister, a brother and sister, and they took violin and piano. And then I gave up on that, or I said I didn't want to do that. And then I tried piano for a year and gave up on that. And so at a certain point, I heard all the music my older brother was into and all that stuff. And I was a nerd, and I thought guitar would help me be cooler, you know, by fifth grade or something like that. And my parents said, you know, we've tried, so you have to prove that, you know, we're not wasting our time here. So I like taught myself to like thrash around a little bit on a old nylon string guitar. And I went far enough to the, where they would get me an electric guitar and then get me some lessons. So all through high school, I played music, and I think I did my first concert with a band, in like freshman year playing covers. I think we played like six songs from the first Police record.
Good choice.
And then a couple of you too enjoy. Yeah, so I was a little I don't know why we were all drawn to, or what I was, that was probably from my brothers and sisters, but my friends and all were, you know, into that. So all through high school I played in like had cover bands and was sort of working through material, and I was taking lessons and eventually played in the jazz band and then that stuff. So I was into that, but at the same time I was like going to school, and I was getting pretty good at golf to the point where I was kind of trying to, I thought maybe I could play for in college. So when it came to picking a school, University of Miami had all these cool courses that were like studio music and all this stuff that looked like, you know, like studio performance. And, you know, I had, by the time I was graduating, I was kind of starting to get into like, you know, like Pat Metheny and stuff like that. And I was into Steely Dan and all the metal, all that stuff was happening too. And I was into that sort of, but a little left fieldy. So I saw all those courses, and then there was, and I thought, well, and also there's like golf down there.
Yeah.
Maybe. So that's what the, you know, sorry, it seems so rambling, but
no, not at all.
So it was just sort of, I still like, I had the gift from my father of saying like, what are you interested in? And like follow that and pursue that. And so I went to University of Miami undecided, arts and science, with the hopes that I'd kind of walk on to the golf team. Funnily enough, there were some other schools that were actually trying to recruit me that I didn't get
golf
into. Yes.
Wow.
There was one called Skidmore that had a great music program, really awesome, almost like Eastman-ish. But I didn't get in. I didn't have the grades, and probably my audition fell flat, but I actually literally had like a letter from a golf coach, which was a crazy thing to imagine. But what I learned when I first got to school at Miami was I was undecided, and I was like, I remember walking through the music school and hearing people playing and immediately thinking like, oh my God, I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I guess I'm not, you know, doing that. And then when I went to look into the golf thing, it was like, well, you have to walk on. You have to, like, there's going to be open tryouts. And I realized, again, which I probably should have known, but, like, once you got to college level, that I was actually too small. It sounds strange for golf.
Yeah.
But I was, like, 120 pounds soaking wet. And when you get to college level, everything gets, the courses get longer. They're like almost like what the pros play on. And I just couldn't compete.
Interesting. Like,
I could score. I was pretty good on like the local level. But as a lot of people learn, you step up to, same with music in a way. I was good in my high school. But you learn that, like, oh, you know, there's fully grown men here playing, and I'd be like being like 30 yards behind them on every shot. Like, you know, and I sort of, there was a basic almost DNA like size thing to it, you know.
I had no idea that that was.
Yeah, it's you know, oh, it's you know, professional sports, you know. So there might be a few small guys, but they're freaks, kind of. I think I don't think they're big like basketball players, but they're professional. They're strong, and it's when you're strong, right? Being strong and like so. And so I was like the first, like completely just undecided, arts and science, like walking around and you know, long story long, I heard this guy play and I loved the way he played, and I was like into playing guitar still. And I loved it. And there was this guy who was also like in the music school, but he was a jazz principal and he was a music, you have to have like a double major. So he was a music education, and I heard this guy play, and I thought he was, I loved the way he played, his taste, his feel. And so I just like figured, well, maybe I'll audition in the second semester and go to music school, because the question was like, when you go to your first year of college, it's like, what's your major? What are you interested in? So I was like, I like music. I mean, look at this music theory, all this stuff. This is what I like. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna try. And this guy I sat with this guy, and he said, like, you know, prepared me for the audition. And since I wasn't going to be a performance major, or I was already at school, I was already enrolled, I could sort of slide into the program.
Amazing.
The back door, kind of, because, and I wasn't even that aware, but at University of Miami, I think my class, including performance, was like six guys.
Wow.
The entirety of the school at the time of guitar players, there's like 25 or 26 guitar players. So, you know, I was around all those same people. And you go to the audition, or you go to placement auditions when you're in school, and there's guys there who are just like burning, like they're playing bebop, right? They're like that. And then there's some guys like me who are like, you know, I like it just trying to figure it out, you know, but have sort of a knack. And I've played music, I played in bands, and, you know, a basic sort of grasp of time and something that they recognize when they see you. And you have to kind of learn a standard, you learn a chord melody, you kind of, like, I don't want to sandbag too much. I was working on it, you know, I had an idea, you know, but again, you're empowered by how small your world is, you know, so.
Yeah, and you know, I think something that I don't really, I've gotten into it a few times with people, but it's never like the main focus. And obviously I don't want to make it the main focus with yourself either, but something that I think often gets overlooked, especially amongst young up and coming musicians, I hear so many things about cover bands, wedding bands, function bands. Oh, I don't want to do that. I want to just do my art kind of thing. Great. Totally cool, right? Art is important. Creating is important. But I think it gets overlooked how to be in a good function band or a good cover band or whatever it is, it's like a lesson in itself. Because mm-hmm. the difference between creating something, while that is still a massive accomplishment, trying to learn note for note something that somebody else, like an Andy Summers character in The Police, has created, that is not easy. That is work. And so for you to kind of like give this perception that, like, oh, look how natural I am at this, when you've had to imitate somebody else's playing, that's work. So, you know, I think maybe, at least the way it sounds, it's like, even with you thinking every now and then, oh, I'm not sure if this is where I fit, or I'm not sure if they're going to like what I do, you probably find playing in these bands and stuff throughout your life, you had this like natural knack, like you say, to just fit in without even realizing, because while you were working on your stuff, you probably had subconsciously worked on so many parts that it was in your DNA by then, you know?
Yes, I think you're probably, and you've had all these conversations, you are hitting on the actual, probably the biggest thing and the main thing. Most of my real skill is function, is being good at what the function is for what I'm doing. And sometimes I get to be more creative, but that function of like, there's very little difference between playing in a wedding band and a top 40 band and doing a gig for a pop star, because what you're doing is like, you're getting a record and you're learning those parts.
Yeah.
Right. And the skill in that scenario is making those parts feel alive and feel like you're not in a wedding band, or feeling like you're still communicating to people, and you still want what you do something to people, to impact them. Not to be too, you know, high-minded about it.
No. But
that's – so, like, function is still the – like, what I do. It's no different. And so getting good at that and being in those scenarios and being with, like, older players that are – because it's still, like, even when you're doing wedding bands when you're first out of school, or you're doing function – like, cover bands, you're probably with guys – who are me now. Like, I'll still, somebody will call me and say, I'm not gonna, and be like, we need to do this thing, and I'm a little crankier about it, or if I can afford to like, I have to be a little more careful with my time, because learning, you know, 50 songs for a gig for X amount of dollars when I have like not even other work, but parenting and all that stuff, I have to figure out, like, you have to work smart, you know?
Yeah.
But even that's a tough equation, because you don't know who's going to be on that gig, who might lead you to more of that stuff. And once you do that initial heavy lifting of all the work, then you can say yes. And it's like easier, you know, to show up. We have less homework. Anyway, that stuff never stops. So function, my skill personally, or what I like to do in a band, is actually function. I am not a virtuoso. I am not, and that's probably why social media is more of a struggle for me, and something I've had, is I am not somebody that sits down and like will like blow your mind with their ability, right? What I like to do and my interest is sort of the working within an ensemble, or especially in a recording, and making something interesting, or making something feel good, and like that collective action that turns into something. I still, even if I like find the music to be horrible or whatever, when I plug in and like play with other people, it's still kind of, I love it. You know what I mean? So I just like that function, and not being kind of a virtuoso, or not feeling like I have this insane ability where everything's kind of beneath me or easy for me. I always feel a little bit lucky. And it comes with the problem of always feeling like a little bit impostery, like I might get found out or something like that. So that every time I do a gig and I play with people and then it's over, I'm like, man, I did it. You know what I mean? I'm like, whew, that was a close one. I made it through again. But I really love the idea of like, you know, the function, like what's the function? What's the right thing at this moment? And you know, leading back to that stuff of that original band with like the Police or U2 or whatever, that original like motivation or like, what are the, you know, if I think about it, like, what are those guys in those bands and in like the Clash, or what are they really good at? They're really good at like the function
of the guitar rather than
like the solos.
Yeah.
And I guess that just became sort of my thing, you know. It has its baggage in this day and age, especially of not being like, you know, blow us away. You know, you need to find people that kind of are going to recognize that you play with, like, or artists or something that sort of you start to play and they hear it. They hear that you're like, they hear where you're coming from, you know.
Yeah, it's an interesting point because, you know, especially with the social media thing, I mean, if we're talking guitar, we're inundated with people shredding in these 20-second clips that just make your jaw drop. But, you know, as somebody who does work in bands myself, I appreciate the skill that takes. I don't try and flaunt for a second. I mean, especially when you see some of these people, like, they're seven and they're playing like Eruption by Van Halen, and you're going like, oh, wait, I still can't play Eruption by Van Halen. Like, what the heck?
Yeah, but it's unbelievable.
It's unreal. But, you know, I sometimes think once you've worked with musicians, and I don't mean for this to sound all high and mighty or even like the old gatekeeper kind of thing. I don't mean for it to come across like that at all. But I think there is a difference. You know, I mean, there are things that I can do by myself when I'm practicing that I think, wow, that's really cool. But I would never do it on a gig because I know that I'm going to get fired from that band if I do it. And even though it's cool and it'll be cool for 20 seconds, the longevity of, like you say, creating parts within that thing, making people feel something, or even just keeping the job, for me personally, that's always been more of a, hey, I think I did a good job today. And, you know, listen, without trying to jump all over the place, in doing my research for this interview, I saw many clips of you, including some great clips with Derek Trucks. And if you can hold your own with Derek Trucks, my man, you are doing it right. Whether you are shredding in 15-second TikTok, Instagram clips or not, you know.
I appreciate that. I was thinking about this before our conversation, but this is very interesting, like this subject, which I'm sure is like well trod ground. But I could really feel bad about myself scrolling through Instagram. I mean, these guys are like, they're shredding, you know, John Coltrane at like the, like, it's unbelievable. It's just amazing. I mean, you get the whole world. It's incredible. But, And it's complicated. I really appreciate your framing of like, I don't want to sound like some old gatekeeper, because I will easily sound like that. Like, there was part of me that looks at that stuff, or looks at, you know, Instagram things and be like, well, there's nothing that, never being an older gatekeeper type, I never think that, well, that's definitely a person I want to play in a band with or be in a tour bus with or thing. However, I think it does, and I have seen, like, even fairly recently, like some guy that was like, I'm always marvel at their like ability to play and solo guitar and all these incredible things and finger tapping and melodies and all, like, incredible. And then I happened to stumble across like them playing like a song with a band, and within like two bars I was like, that feels weird, like it doesn't feel right.
Yeah,
now it's easy to I can easily fall into that. Like, there's nothing that any Instagram or anybody playing by themselves tells me that makes me say like that should be I want that guy in a gig. That said, when you're talking about certain gigs that maybe I've aged out of, you're talking about pop or like actually a lot of gigs now, what are they doing? They're playing, you're playing with tracks, right? So like it, they might not be unqualified for that because it's not, like, so it gets a little different when you're talking about like the world of sort of roots music, whatever, Americana, or kind of, that's why you see all these guys like in my view, like there's this push of people playing like bluegrass and playing all this, these kind of musics, because even like the sort of real guys who are touring and stuff, because, and I haven't done it that much lately. I didn't realize how much, because there's people are, you're always playing with tracks in like pop gigs. So the guys that are doing big pop gigs, they kind of come home and do gigs where that involve like real playing with real people to like kind of show, or do records that, like, even a record's not a good metric anymore because you could do anything. It could be like,
oh yeah, anything. Know?
But yeah, like, so people are like, I'm just going to sit here, we're going to play bluegrass. So like, this is, the, you know, or, and I haven't had a gig in a little while that was like track based. And I was talking to my friend Joe Ayoub, who does like the voice, and he was just trying to explain to me like how much bands that don't even look like they should have tracks, like a folk group, like when you see them on late night shows or whatever, that they're all using tracks, like it's become, so I'm a little aged out. Like I have to get back and understand like what's going on in terms of like, so that's a long, long way of saying that yeah, maybe for certain gigs, like if it's with tracks or whatever, that's fine, you know, but when it comes to sort of things that I like and what I, you know, and maybe now it's more legacy stuff or whatever, where everyone's just playing together and it's, and maybe it's just a click or in the studio or whatever, that feel, especially in the studio, like being able to play together and having control over the time and feeling like, it, you know, like being this, a piece of this organic puzzle and making it feel really good. That's a skill that, like, yeah, that solo Instagram guitar or all that stuff doesn't help, you know.
I couldn't agree more. It comes with playing with people.
Yeah.
And, you know, as to you said, like, earlier on in the interview, it's like, that's something they can't teach. You've got to get on stage with people. You've got to be in rehearsal rooms with people. Listen, I know it's changed. You know, I mean, if I think back to when I was a kid, learning or trying to learn and be in bands and all that stuff, I sometimes look at the advances of things like YouTube or having a DAW on your phone now and things like that. And it's
right.
Like, I sometimes think to myself, wow, I wish I had all of that stuff. And then another part of my brain goes, I wonder if I had all that stuff, if I would have tried as hard. And I'm stereotyping. I'm not saying people don't try hard. Some of these people out there are incredible. There's zero doubt about that.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to say that at all. But, you know, I remember how hard it was to get information. You know, if I found a player that I liked, I had the access to the linear notes of the record, right? Or the CD, whatever it was. And then, you know, you were lucky if you saw a music magazine where they had an interview with this person and you were like, wow, but it didn't really tell you anything about the player of the, it told you, you know, like what they ate for breakfast in their third hotel on tour kind of thing. Now it's like, I can type anything in. And it's wonderful. Like isolated drum track for such and such a song,
right,
2 minutes 14. And I'll find it. And wow, this is amazing. I always thought it did this, but it does that. And it's like, it's amazing. But I sometimes just wonder, like, I just wonder where it's going to go, you know? And I don't mean to sound like an old man when I say this stuff, but I wonder where it's going to go, because it's like, there are people who are so embraced in it. And it's wonderful. You need to be. Change or die, right? That's what they say. There's a whole nother school of it for me that I sometimes just wonder, like, I saw a guitar plugin recently, a producer friend of mine was showing me, And this thing was incredible. I can't unfortunately remember the name of the plugin, but he himself, he's not very musically inclined as a player. He's very musically gifted brain-wise. He can arrange songs and he's great with tempo and key and he can figure out harmonies. He's a producer for a reason. You know, he's incredible in that vein. But as a guitarist, noodling would be a compliment to him. And he'd be the first to admit. And he says to me, I got to show you this guitar plugin, right? So I'm like, oh man, I've seen all the guitar plugins kind of thing, right? And he's like, no, you got to check this out. Mm-hmm. He plays like 3 or 4 notes really badly on this little electric guitar he had hanging around. And I'm thinking, like, okay, like, what is going to be great about this?
I don't like the word.
Oh my God. I don't know if I should be depressed or happy. I think depressed is how I left, but he says to me, check this out. Who do you want that to sound like? And I'm like, what do you mean? Who do I want that to sound like? And he goes, I can choose styles like from the most iconic guitarists in the world. So Hendrix, Vi, Slash, you name it. Like there was about a dozen guitarists, right? And I'm like, well, I don't know, man. Like Hendrix, dude. And he hits the Hendrix like little button on this plugin. And then, you know, like with most plugins, you can choose how much you mix into your actual track. Well, he's like, look, check this out. And dude, he starts adjusting the mixing knob on this little plugin. And it goes from him playing these like 4 notes kind of badly to sort of 4 notes with a bit more reverb and a bit more feel. And it starts to have that sort of Hendrix tone. And then he mixes it more and it's gone from 4 notes to 8 and there's a bit of delay. And listen, we went through about 3 or 4 of the guitarists. And it changed the style of those 4 or 5 notes that he played to the point that he sounded like an incredible guitarist. And I was like, oh my gosh. Like at first I was like, I was trying to play it cool. You know, I was like, yeah, no one's going to use that. And thinking, oh my God, in another year I'll have no work kind of situation. But it's just unreal.
Yeah, you said it. I guess the real... Also, my brain is like, well, I hope, you know, those guitarists are like, they're getting paid somehow.
Me too.
That's another really scary part of it. I guess drummers have been sort of reckoning with this for a longer time, you know. But yeah, it's very, you know, another thing too is that like we consume everything in sort of a minute, or was TikTok can be 3 minute, like that's a whole different thing too, you know. And actually, to go back to your generous compliment, like playing like the thing with Derek, like the point is that it was wonderful playing with him, and yeah, it felt great, and you know, but I have to put a caveat on it. There's a huge difference between, you know, jamming for a couple songs and playing a couple solos and what he does for 2 hours every night. Right. And so that's a big difference, but at the same time, like that's the job too. It's playing 2 hours every night or doing like whatever. If you think about some guy that plays some insane, you know, thing or some incredible like Instagram of some guy playing some mind-boggling technical thing or thing like that, like, you know, okay, like how about a gig for 60 minutes and like what are you gonna say, you know? That does so those things are very separate. And actually maybe the silver lining on the plugin and all that stuff is like the premium will now be on like the people that can stand on stage and play for and have something to say in real life, in real time, because you know, so hopefully, you know, because that's a big challenge, you know, and to be honest, like there's so many incredibly skilled players, but to go out and see some music and not feel like, okay, I'm kind of bored, you know, is like, you know, I try and set the bar not to be a jerk about it, but just to try and have perspective on where I want things to be. And because I'm fortunate to have really played with and been on stage with people who are just incredible, like the way music comes out of them and they reach people. You know, a lot of times if you go see some music, you like, it's kind of normal to be like, oh, that sounds good, or to be like thing. But you know that like these people who are really great, like there's just like, you don't even have time to decide. They just like, it just hits you like a physical thing that you get blindsided by it. So when you go to a club or something and you see something that's really like really visceral and urgent, you just know it. So I think that will always still be sort of like where we have to hope there's, you know,
I do agree.
Still value, you know, because it, like in a way things become just like sort of misinformation, you know, but like, or the uncanny valley, you know, where you're looking at something and it's like, you can't tell in your bones, you just, something doesn't feel right, or it doesn't feel good. You know, it doesn't give you the same feeling, but who knows? At the same time, as older guy, I do try and keep in mind that, like, I heard Pete Townsend, one of my favorites also say, you know, I'm at my age, if I understand what a 21-year-old is doing, they're doing it wrong.
That's true. Like, that's actually a like great way to look at it.
It's supposed to be like kind of baffling and confusing, and so, and yeah. So I thought that was a really valuable.
Yeah, I agree. Adam, let's switch gears for a second. Let's talk about the Ziggy Marley gig. I know you've been with Ziggy for quite a while. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, your credits are just super, super impressive. I'm not going to list them now, but I know I said it already. I'll list them in the intro.
Thank you.
If you wouldn't mind, I know you mentioned that you got the Shakira gig. And I know that there was probably a transition period from going from like these jam bands and the cover bands and the function bands into getting that gig. But more specifically, tell us a little bit about how you got involved with Ziggy and how that gig came about for you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, the gig came about just because, so I had moved to LA and been here for a few years, maybe 10, a little less than 10 years. But I ran into I was sharing a studio space with somebody in a big building in LA, and somewhat to house gear and to work, and that became like a whole valued community. When I moved to LA, I had already had a few friends already, and that was kind of an important piece of that. And one of my friends, when they were all really, you know, kind of great players and people, and we were really fortunate, you know, awesome peer group to sort of know. And so at some point I ran into one of them who said, like, you know, we're talking, and he said, well, I have an audition for, I might do Ziggy gig. And I sort of lit up and I was like, because in a way, like when I was in Miami, I played a lot. I had this band called the Spam All Stars, which led me into some of the jam band stuff. But it was very like, it was with Cuban musicians, and it was very like beat based, where I played a lot of groove and a lot of pocket stuff. And I loved doing that. And I also did play a few gigs with, or spent a little time with Inner Circle, the like a reggae band, although functionally in a different role. So I had moved to LA and I was enjoying it, but I was doing like, funnily enough, I, you know, was playing with all these like singer songwriters and doing those kind of gigs. And I, when I heard about Ziggy, I thought like, oh man, I would, that would be awesome. I would love to do that. And, get back to playing some groove and stuff like that. So, it turned out that this guy couldn't, he had other commitments, and I sort of, you know, asked him to put my name, give my name to management. And then I kind of pushed on it a little bit because I didn't know it, but so they were going on tour and I didn't know it, but really he didn't necessarily need another guitar player. Like he doesn't, unlike a lot of gigs, he doesn't really use subs. He'll like, if it's not the drummer, or the bass player, he'll just go kind of a man down and he'll play with, because it's like, he's real serious about the music and he's not trying to like, it's, you know, not that other people don't do a great job, but it's like, you know, he doesn't, he's not that interested in that. But at this time, like the other guitar, so when I reached out or they got in touch, I sort of said, you know, I'd really like to do it. And they said, well, we're not sure if what Ziggy's going to do, if he's going to take another guitar, but the other guitar player was going to be busy because he was going to do he does the subs and the Kimmel show, and his role, he's an amazing guitar player and he's still in the band today. He's a dear friend and he's way more of a ringer than me in a lot of sense. But I did kind of push a little bit and like stay in touch and say like, well, you know, the tour's coming up and you'll know this week. And so at some point they said, you know, okay, come to Ziggy's house and just sit with him and like learn these four songs. So there was no full band audition. There was like literally me sitting with Ziggy and his other guitar player, like playing songs without a rhythm section, playing reggae without a rhythm section. And so I had like worked up a lot of the parts being like sort of a little more of like the part side of the equation for this particular role. And so I was playing all the parts, right. And I felt like, you know, I've been doing this a long time. It was like kind of felt like, oh, I'm a pro, I can do this, whatever. What I realized in hindsight, and eventually, so they decided to like sort of bring me along for this 6-week run. And what I realized in hindsight was like, I thought like, oh, I nailed it, whatever. And what in hindsight, I realized that they were just like, yeah, we can work with this. Because these are the real guys and they're playing the music that they've lived their whole lives. And so there's a, like a real lesson of sort of knowing, like, I don't think I was like had any hubris or anything. I think I'm pretty good about that from all my experience in the past. But even still, you know, understanding that like it sort of when it comes just like in the blues or something like that, you know, the pro air quotes attitude of like, oh, I can play anything. I got this. It's like, it's not really that useful. It's more coming from the other direction. Like, wow, this is really deep and I have to like, you know, kind of be in service to this and understanding that like the sort of abstract feeling and the sort of the space between everything is really sort of a lived and lifelong pursuit. that, and I think that helps actually with how they view you and how you approach the gig, and it helps like make how the music sounds.
Yeah.
So I think that a little bit was a little bit useful. And even still, even after halfway, 3/4 of the way through the run, you know, I was playing rhythm guitar just with Ziggy and he'd stop me and, you know, playing the simplest thing you could imagine and stop me and look at me like, yeah. Give it another 20 years. You know? So basically, and that's kind of a compliment. That's a gift if somebody say that to you,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So yeah. And then I didn't do the gig for a few years, but he invited me to play on, the a couple of records and then got brought along in a couple of years later. So they kind of, at the end of that run, they sort of said, the guy said, I said to those guys, like, oh, I don't know if I'll see you guys again. They're like, oh no, you'll be around. Like, this gig works like once you're in sort of the crew, you know, he keeps people around. So
that's cool. It sounds like a family situation, which is nice given how the pop touring world seems to work. That's really nice, you know.
Yeah, well, it's also real serious. Like, they're real, he's real, it's real serious, you know.
Listen, I know we're running a little behind. I'm sorry about that. I'm gonna choose.
I think it's my fault.
No, not at all. Not at all. You're actually so easy to talk to that I think I've also butt in too much. So my apologies. I just mentioned family with Ziggy, so let's actually shoot topics again and let's talk family. I know you have a family. Possibly a bit of a strange topic to talk about on a music podcast, but talk to me, if you don't mind, about some of the difficulties you may or may not have when it comes to juggling being a dad and a husband when you have a job that demands so much time of you.
Oh my gosh. Well, there are a lot of difficulties. To start with, when you're single and you're doing this job, everything is just sort of like, you know, you go on tour, you don't... It's a lot easier to leave, for one, as opposed to, like, and the cost is a lot lower, really, just personally and emotionally, and everything you make is just going to you, right? And so the equation is very different. So that gets really difficult. And one thing I always talk about with other friends of mine is before I had a family and was married and I'd be on tour and you have days off, they were just like the greatest thing you could imagine. Like, imagine you're in a new city. It's like you have no responsibilities and you're just free and you're hanging out, whatever. Now days off are sort of like these weird melancholy, you know, limbo, sort of where I just feel kind of sad, even if, you know, I'm in the beautiful city or whatever, because you think of you're away from your family and everything. So, and I realized, like, one of the difficulties is really, one, just not, that the math is just, is a lot tougher, but it's a lot more just what regular people deal with, you know. I could like be real upset about it but that's really like because I had such an incredible fortunate run for so long, you know. You realize when you're in your 30s and single and touring the world and everything, and you'll be like, you know, realize that most people don't get to do that. And so now, you know, it's a lot more like break even and than it used to be. You tour and you have money and you have this time when you get off tour to relax, because you know, everything's a lot more, you know, grown up and adult. that's a different kind of experience that I'm, you know, that I think for everybody is just learning every day. But I'm so fortunate to have like an amazing, you know, wife and partner that like understands kind of the thing that I do and what I do and who I am, that it's, I mean, that's the really kind of the main thing. And I go away and she's, you know, basically by herself handling two kids and working her job and being a superhero while I get to go on tour. So one of the real challenges is that, like, is sort of the whiplash of that, and realizing that when I come home, I have to be the best parent I can and giving as much time to that as possible, or there's not really much choice. And so that makes sort of the transition to finding work in town and hustling like that much more challenging. And I can't help but sort of prioritize the parenting. Because in a lot of ways we're both creatives and we're just making ends meet. But I have to hope that if I'm spending a lot of time parenting, that it'll be, you know, it'll pay a dividend later when they're older. If you know, it's not as easy for us to like sort of give them, you know, all the legs up that I might have if I worked like a regular job and made more money. So that's sort of a little bit of the balance you're trying, or the challenges you're trying to find. I do think it will, you know, pay off, but it's a, you know, you are making like, there's you do think of all that math differently. You know, yeah. What I mean?
Yeah. Time becomes more precious.
Time is very precious. And I'm older too. I had kids late in life. Because I was so fortunate and had such a good run, you really do see that the value of everyone says that it's a trope, like you'll never regret spending more time with your kids, and the regret that people have, like as they get older, they didn't. So I sometimes stress that I'm not like working and making more money for them. And that is a constant stress. I think that's a constant stress for everybody with the family.
I think so.
But at the same time, I know that like I am spending a lot of time. I'm getting to be there as active a parent as I can.
Yeah, yeah, and that's more valuable than the financial side. You know, in the long run, I believe you probably are right.
I hope so. I hope so. That's where I'm putting my, you know, that's what I'm choosing so far. So, I've had some well-to-do people tell me as much, but you know, who knows?
I'm going to start wrapping up because I want to respect your time, but I want to ask you two last questions if that's okay. I saw that you had a few film and TV / composition credits, as well as all your sideman and band work. If you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about if your approach is different when doing this as compared to, say, working as a sideman or a band guy. And also, what tips would you offer listeners wanting to try and potentially get into this type of vocation?
Let's see. The first thing, I really like doing that work. But I can't say it came to me as like in the standard way. I was fortunate in that I met a guy who was worked for a commercial production company. And so it was much more of a straight line, and him saying like, hey, do you want to do music for this? And me and a partner sort of for this ad. And then he basically pitched us, and we had to, you know, do a little demo, like come up with some stuff. But basically they would normally go to a music house or people that work in these, and they're just like these, you know, incredibly skilled sort of people like your friend who can churn out stuff really quickly. And doing some of the film and TV stuff, I work with a guy, and it's just like, it is astounding how fast he can make music. And how quickly he can like fit something to a picture and things like that. I was not exactly doing that. I was basically in a position to pitch, get a directive and pitch to the director and the creator. So it was kind of a straight line, where a lot of times these things work a little bit like, plantation is a little rough, but like people get sort of a directive of like, they're looking for this. And then there's 100 guys that make demos, and they filter for like, you know, $150 or $200 if they're lucky. And then that gets filtered up to, so I was just able to like, to, you know, be like short circuit that. It's a little more of like an artist, like that they're hiring, And I really like that process. I wish I could, I would like to do more. The way in is still kind of tough because so many people are trying to do that because it's one of the clearest, like most monetized things in the business. Right. But that work is a lot, is different. And what I like about it and what I wish I could do more is that, it's really like solving a puzzle, and you don't have like, you don't have to have exactly your artistic, you know, sensibilities tied up in it, but it also does involve the fact, like having a large sort of background of music to pull from. So all the credits, all the stuff, all the crazy music I'm interested in, all that stuff. So like, I really enjoyed that idea. Like a director usually has a temp track or something like that. And I like that process of sort of saying like, well, here's this some indie band that he thinks is really cool that they're not paying for. And then it's my job to sort of figure out, like, get in the zone of that. If it sounds too much alike, usually it reminds them too much of the thing they can't afford. So it has to be kind of have some element of surprise, make them feel cool. So I enjoyed that process. And it really involves sort of thinking of like the DNA of where things are coming from. So I enjoyed that, and I might have lost track of the second part of the question, the advice of getting into that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was just, you know, would you offer any tips on like listeners who want to try and get into that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think I mean, a little bit of the session stuff, I've done a few of those things, mainly just from like through referral and, you know, being a good reader can help. I have friends who are like really aces, the top guys, and I'm not as good a reader than that. But it's always something I'm trying to get better at. And the hard part of that is like, it's not like riding a bike, it goes away. So I did one of the things I did years ago was a house band on a TV show. And I basically like, it was like being thrown into the pool and just figuring out how to swim. And I could read music sort of, but the sight reading thing is a real challenge. I don't think that's really necessary. I think the people that do a lot of the commercial stuff, they have really great, I think keyboard skills and like drum programming skills are really valuable for that work. But it's, you got to really like it because I think it can be really a real slog and a commitment in a lot of ways because they get jerked around a lot. You know, I've been fortunate to work with people that are like kind of high up on the food chain on it. The commercial thing, the stuff I got to do, we still got our, you know, jerked around a bit, but we were fortunate, in that sense. And I had hoped to kind of push into that more, but then, you know, I think I went on the road and my partner in it sort of like, once you kind of drop out a little bit, and actually the connection, the guy I was doing it with, I think he was with different projects and things like that. So being always plugged into that is sort of its own universe, and you know, we'll see. I'm trying to still do it.
Well, good luck.
Thank you,
Adam. Last question: what do you feel has been the best piece of advice you've ever received, or potentially figured out along the way in regards to having a musical career?
Oh my God. I don't know. I'm going to end up having to throw something out. Actually, specific to musical things always are a little easier than personal stuff. So the musical thing was always just somebody that said to me, if you can make a triad sound exotic, you're on to something. So it sort of is like sort of exactly that thing of what we were talking about earlier, feel, like how you make music feel is going to be if you can make things feel good, and you can make things feel good to the people you're playing with and the people that you're listening to, that's sort of the best way to keep working. But personal advice, I don't know. There really is, like, everyone that I know that I call a friend and is a peer and is successful are really just are people that I really admire and are really good people, and people I would be fine living and traveling with in a small space for 6 weeks at a time, you know. So being a person that's easy to get along with and good to be in a room with and understanding and is really the thing that keeps you working. People you got to be a person that people want to hang out with, you know. And that's not always easy, you know. Some of people who are virtuosos and who are the most amazing players, they pay a price sometimes doing all in terms of their, you know, personal skills. So the cream of the very top are like these guys that are both, you know. And so hopefully that's of some value.
That's amazing. All right, excellent. Adam Zimon, thank you so, so, so very much for your time, man. I had a really fun conversation. I actually, you know, I feel like I say this to a few people, but not everybody. It's amazing when I look at my list of questions, how much stuff we could have still spoken about. So I love it when you can talk to somebody you've never met before, and just, it kind of goes back to almost what you just said in the advice kind of answer. It's like, it's an attest to the type of character you are, at least in my opinion, that we could talk so freely having not really ever hung out. So I thank you for your time. I wish you nothing but the best for the future and all of your musical endeavors and your family and everything. And, you know, if you're ever in New Orleans, just drop me a line. We'll go get some gumbo or something.
Oh, we didn't even get into New Orleans.
We didn't even get into New Orleans.
My gosh. And that's really it. Yeah.
We'll have to have you back.
The feeling is mutual. Thank you so much.
Thanks again, buddy. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you, Travis.
I'd like to publicly thank Adam for his time. I'd like to thank each and every one of you for your time. As I said at the top of the episode, my name is Travis Mark. You can find out more about me at travismark.com. You can find out more about The Musician's Mentor at musicians-mentor.com. Make sure you check out Adam at adamzimon.com. As usual, don't forget to leave us a rating or review. But until next time, keep pushing, and I'll catch you then. Peace.